Welcome to Lives, a show exploring our experiences in the world and how we might live well. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden, and my guest today is Laura Rocafort, an organizational development consultant and leadership coach. Rocafort talks about her many decades working globally to develop individuals and leadership teams, and her passion for helping people create environments that are authentic, supportive, and inclusive. We also talk about the recent death of her husband, Rich, from the neurodegenerative disease, ALS, what she experienced, and what comes next.
We don't understand when people have a disease like ALS or Parkinson's or MS or any neurological disorder, or even Alzheimer's, how to love and how to care and how to be compassionate and advocate and be there for them. And I know that my life's work prepared me to be there for Rich.
Laura Rocafort is an organizational development consultant and leadership coach who has for decades worked globally with individuals and leadership teams who want to develop and grow. Originally from Sacramento, California, Rocafort has lived in Nebraska for over 30 years with her late husband, Rich, and holds a BA in organizational communication from California State University, a Master's of Education from the University of Nebraska at Lincoln, and is a certified senior professional in human resources. Laura Rocafort, welcome to Lives.
Thank you, Stuart. It's great to be with you.
So your long-form bio that you shared with me says that you are passionate about helping people create environments that are authentic, supportive, and inclusive. What are environments that are authentic, supportive, and inclusive?
Yeah, and when I say that, my work as a leadership development expert and coach is to model all of that whenever I'm with a group or with an individual. So it comes from a place of believing that if we aren't our authentic self, truly our authentic self, then we can't be willing to learn about other people and their authentic selves. And so there's a growth to that, a development to that. And so authenticity to me means you are who you are and you show up that way no matter where you are. And there used to be that conversation about you have a home Stuart and you have a work Stuart. I want the whole Stuart to come to whatever environment I'm a part of. And I want to help to create those inside of organizations. You know, supportive is that it runs the gamut to me on how do we treat people in the workplace when things are hard for them. And having recently gone through the loss of a spouse, I think I'm more sensitive to that now when we think about the hard things people are going through. And companies, people give their vacation time to support other people so they can be out on their own. I want those kinds of cultures in every workplace so that we're taking care of each other. In fact, I know someone right now that's a CEO who's been having some health challenges, and the support that that person is being given is phenomenal. And I think that diversity, it's so interesting. For me, I've always liked working with people who are different of thought, different of age, different backgrounds, different races, because it's eclectic and interesting and fun. And you can see environments at work that are exclusively all women or exclusively all men or exclusively all X. And there's not that richness of age diversity, race diversity, gender diversity. And when we have that, and Simon Sinek has talked about this, we have all the voices being heard, and that creates a much richer organization. So, you know, for me, my work is in that realm, working with organizations and people in them.
It's interesting when you reference the Stuart at home and the Stuart at work and the Stuart wherever he, meaning me, happens to be. But you want the whole Stuart to turn up. And honestly, I'm not entirely sure from day to day, who is the whole Stuart? How do you deal with that kind of confusion, both with individuals and then the team and the organization?
Well, when you say I'm not sure who the whole steward is, that's a development quest for you. But if we say, well, steward, I only like you like this. I only like the steward who shows up like this. Then the days you show up different than that, it's confusing to us. And I want to understand what's behind that. Is there some fear? Is there some anxiety? Is there something going on that's creating that steward? Or is that the real steward? And we just haven't seen that steward yet. So I think it's exciting and interesting to me, more interesting to learn about people as they are than as we typecast them to be or want them to be.
The long form bio that you provided said that you're passionate about this. Why are you passionate? Where does that emerge from?
I think that the passion has come partly through my own experience, as it does. You know, I've been deselected 3 times inside of a corporation. And each time that I was deselected, my word, not terminated, not asked to resign, all those things, but just kind of kicked off the team, it's because I was not genuine. And in some ways, it was me trying to be what I thought other people wanted me to be, and I couldn't be successful that way. And what I discovered, and this is not going to be a shock to people who know me well, but I really love love. I really love kindness. I really love grace. And I felt like I needed to be anything but that. Now, I don't know if that's true. I haven't worked inside of corporations now for about 13 years. They could have changed, but it was really hard for me to show that part of myself. So the passion somewhat comes from me, but it's also watching and being a part of human resources and watching us deselect people because they didn't fit. Instead of thinking about them as human beings and where do you fit? And having those kinds of honest, helpful conversations.
I would imagine the state of corporate America organizational life today is very different from what it was when you started. So perhaps let's jump back a little bit. And if we were thinking about the culture at corporate America and how people were treated, what did it look like when you first embarked on this career?
I remember coming into work. I started in nonprofit. And I think there's a little difference between the corporate world and the nonprofit world then and now, and that it's all hands on deck. You really get a chance, because there's not a lot of resources, there's not a lot of money, you get a chance to play and learn. And that was the case then. But I remember saying this all the time, that I joined my father's corporation. You could smoke at your desk, you had Rolodex. Was that what they were called? Rolodexes. And then, you know, rotary dial phones. And I think that men and women were different in workplaces back then. There was a power dynamic that is softening. I wouldn't say changed completely, but softening. And I think that's changed corporations, politics. I remember having this idea that men will often say, boy, it's really changed in politics. And I think, yes, because you're working with women and people who are gay and people who are Black and brown. And so, yes, it has changed a lot. And because of that, we have to change. And I think that's where my thinking has evolved as I've grown. I think I carried some of that with me, that sense that we're all unique, we're all different, we all bring something valuable. But I joined the band and just kind of played what the rhythm was at that time, you know, of what we were supposed to be. But I've seen great changes inside of corporations, from buttoned up suits and ties to people being much more relaxed and real in what they bring, their dogs, their cats, their kids. And COVID really changed that. We really see people for who they are. And I hope that continues. I hope there's not a sense that we want to go back to something that looks more formal, because I think that's making us better.
I want to ask you just to explain a little bit more about what is the nature of the work that you do?
My work specifically is to help create healthy organizations. And so I look at my work mostly artistically, mostly creatively, but somewhat scientifically too, because I think if we're trying to evolve an organization from the way it starts, all organizations start with a vision and a mission and a dream of what they want to create. And then as time goes on, they may move away from that because the money's better over here than it is here. And we start chasing something other than the mission and the vision and the purpose and the people that are helping to create that. So I think in some senses, that's one thing that's changed, not for the better, in my view, from when I started working. And I started working when interest rates were at 19%. And there weren't a lot of jobs for kids like me coming out of college. There was a great sense of gratitude and a great sense of wanting to learn and be taught. And then being able to contribute when you had learned Grasshopper and were ready to teach. So I think there's a yin and a yang to all that, don't you think? I mean, I think that we've changed in some ways for the better, that we're looser, we're less structured, we're more open in our cultures. We invite in differences and we celebrate that. I do a lot of diversity, equity, inclusion facilitation. I love that work. I do it with Monique Cannon, who's fabulous, and I feel like our workplaces are evolving to that in a positive way. But like I've said earlier, I still do see the challenges of the connections of power. Like if I sit in the C-suite, does that mean I'm better than you? Or does that mean something that maybe I went to school, I learned this, I came up this way, I understand things that you don't understand. And so that gives me the privilege of having that job, but does that privilege me in other ways? You know, should I be better than you? Should I have perks better than you? Should I don't know how I feel about that truly, having been outside of corporations, because I can call myself president and owner, but I know I'm one person in a group of many whenever I come into a room. And I don't think I'm one up or one down. You know, I'm really part of something that we're going to co-create together. So I would like to see that continue to shift. I'd like to see CEOs not be so cloistered, or C-suites not be so cloistered inside of our corporations.
So in some ways, the consequences of the pandemic, the requirements of COVID demanded that we did cloister in some ways. And it wasn't just COVID too. There were social and political events happening at the time, the murder of George Floyd. So what were some of the good things that you saw, the mindset shifts you saw coming out of that, that maybe are continuing with some nurturing? And maybe where are we sort of swinging back into something, I don't know, less palatable from your perspective?
You bring up a really good point. We wonder if we can't see each other when it comes to work and there is an exchange, we're being paid to do that work. Are we working? Or are we taking our dogs for walks? Or are we doing our laundry or cooking dinner? And we might be. And the trust factor is really important. And I would say that foundationally, as Patrick Lencioni has said, trust is the foundation. And if we know that people get up every day wanting, which I believe, to do the best that they can, there may be things that keep them from being able to do that in a day. But was that not true when we were in the office together? Very likely. And when you ask the question about, yes, it changed us. It caused us to realize that we had to trust. We had to know that work would be getting done. And if we didn't know how to trust, we were having a really hard time with that experience. If we did know how to trust, it was really exciting. And those were the organizations that were playing the games and sending food home and having happy hours and staying connected to each other. And they were finding fun ways to be able to do that and stay in community. And that's exciting to me, because can we stretch into what is in the moment that something changes? Can we do that? And we saw some people, leaders who couldn't, some executives who couldn't. And now people are being invited, if not voluntold, to come back to work and be in the office. And sometimes it's a flex schedule, which people have always wanted. So it's 3 days in, 2 days out. And that's working for people. I interviewed someone from Cox Communications who was the head of HR nationally, or at least regionally. I can't remember if he was the head nationally, but they had conversations with people asking, what do we do? How do we do this? And they set up a tool and resource that people could use that if you had to be in the office, like news, although they did find a way to do that by Zoom and to keep people at home to be safe. But part of the news, if you watch the Today Show, is the fun that they're having on camera together. So this tool that they used was, where are the places we need to all be together and where are the places that we don't? And can we come together 4 times a year, like on a quarterly basis, gain energy from each other and then go out again? But I would prefer that be a conversation and not a telling.
And where perhaps in your work, your observation, are we perhaps falling into mindsets that you see as less productive, maybe even some backlash, not least, for example, around efforts towards diversity, equity, and inclusion? Certainly there's a backlash towards that. So is there anything happening now that you think, oh, here's a place we don't want to go back to, or this is the challenge that is present for corporations today?
I do want a way for us to be seen so we're known as someone who's promotable, someone who could do that special project. And if we're not together and seen, that can be a challenge. I also like the idea of finding creative ways to do that so people can still manage their life. I think what we learned in COVID is that they could. And what scared me a lot with COVID was when kids weren't learning because they couldn't learn under that platform, and their parents needed to be on calls all day, and their parents couldn't be supervising and weren't the supervisor, the teacher was, but the kids weren't on calls. I mean, they weren't on them. They weren't going. And so how do we support one another? It goes back to that word support. When we have things that change like that. And I don't know the answers to that. And I think that collectively we can find the answers to that. I know there has been some things that people have done. Like when there's bad weather, they're now letting kids come to school on Zoom. And that works for those kids that like to be on Zoom. But is there a way that, and maybe there is, I don't know, that teachers can ask parents, you know, how does your child learn, and what's the easiest way for us to access them and support them from home? You know, should they have a neighbor kid come over and sit with them? Because that will help them be more reinforced in the learning. So I like that. I like the creative ways that we can stretch.
With a focus on leaders, you've talked about sort of power dynamics, and it remains true that despite your preference for conversational engagement, we still have leaders. And a lot of your work is in developing their talents and their abilities as leaders. From your perspective, what is a leader?
I think I love Meg Wheatley's definition of what leadership is, and it's anyone willing to take action. So we do have leaders in positions where they have influence and they have power. And how they use that is where I spend my work. And I believe that the first and most important work of leadership is compassion. And compassion means that I know you, I care about you, I'm interested in you. I want to understand you as a person and how you work and what excites you. I think leadership is also about courage. You know, those times where we know we need to speak up and we don't, and we silence ourselves or we let ourselves be silenced for fear, which is true. And I'm not saying be courage in a way that is going to hurt your career, but knowing the time, knowing the place, knowing the when, being prepared, thinking about what it is that you want to say, and having that conversation respectfully is really important to courage. I don't know if these are in any order, but humility is also important for leaders to understand that because you got to this great place to have this impact and this influence, you are also one of many. You are one of many helping to co-create something that's really going to be incredible. And knowing that you're not one up or one down, but you're one of, is important for me for humility.
When you were describing your first forays into the corporate world, and I think you said it's like you were entering your father's workplace. Right. I can imagine describing those characteristics as the ones you were trying to cultivate in a leader would have had you laughed out of a room. Yeah. I don't know if it's any better today. How are you finding the work that you do? How receptive are organizations to this kind of work?
I find that there is a tribe for that. There is a tribe, and that tribe is willing and interested and excited. And I've never been a person that's valued coercion. You know, in some ways I had to in my early career when I was teaching leadership as a younger facilitator of leadership and learning the course that I was teaching, whether it was some kind of a DDI, which is curriculum you can buy off the shelf and learn to facilitate, or any number of courses that you can learn to facilitate inside of a corporation. In those cases, what did we call them back then? We'd call them prisoners or something like that, that they were in the classroom, didn't want to be there. They were very unhappy being taught in this way, the 10 steps to something, to how to coach or how to give a performance review. I think maybe it was my 25th year of doing that work. I'm kind of a slow study. I thought, I don't think that this is right. And I don't think that this is who I am to facilitate this. I really believe in these core principles, and I have a value for kindness and compassion. So that's what I want to do. And if there's an audience for that and there's an interest in that, those will be the people that I will help to become the best that they can be. In that way. Now, I say that, and that's not to say I haven't coached people from the place that they are. And it might be more along the lines of, you know, a really strong, dogmatic, my way or the highway kind of person, but they may not be getting the results that they want. That may not be working for them. So I remember learning from a guy who said, you have to teach a Rottweiler to live in the world and not bark as much as you have to teach a golden retriever to live in the world and not lick everybody. So, you know, we have personalities, and we come with those personalities. But as a leader, what are we trying to do? We're trying to bring people together around a common cause, and where we can all make a difference and be rewarded at the end of the day for that work.
The future then of leadership feels very different than perhaps what it was, certainly pre-pandemic, if not, you know, some decades ago. What is the ongoing need that you see locally or with the clients that you have, you know, more broadly?
You know, I'm really thinking on my feet a little bit here, because I do work with an organization here called ICANN. It's the Institute for Career Advancement Needs. And it started out supporting women in leadership because there wasn't a place for that. And women bring their own capabilities and talents, and we were dressed like men, looking like men, padded shoulders, ties, bow ties. And we were trying to figure out, who were we in this new world of work where women could rise to the highest level if that's what they wanted to do? And so in that process, I started there as someone walking into the world as a woman. I didn't have a mother who did that. I didn't have a grandmother who did that. I was the second generation of women doing that. And what did that mean? And what was leadership? And leadership, we talked about it being both managing and being able to get work done through practices and processes and to manage those things so that we could get from point A to point B together. And then there became this term leadership of being more about who you are and how you motivate and how you influence and how you bring people together, because we're all different. So that was the initial discussion of about what leadership was. It was a both and, leadership and management. I think today, because we have so many tools that manage for us, technical tools that manage, cars that manage for us, automated everything, that more and more important, it's our relationships. And for me, it's always been about relationships. How do we connect? Influence is an interesting word because I don't see that as a manipulative thing, but how do we influence the community we live in? And we live in a community that's been influenced by a variety of people, and it's beautiful for that reason. So I see more of that. I see more collective we. I see people who will start getting the ball rolling that will be at the top, pulling people together to help, pulling systems together, tools together, figuring it out together, and we'll be more connected than we've ever been in finding those resources internally and externally to help us. What I'm really shocked at is all of the buildings that don't have people in them anymore. And so what will that look like as we go forward? And maybe it is that imaginary facility. We all work for the same company, but we also support that company as externals, as people who know things that that company needs and have the right attributes to work with that company. So that'll be more pod-like to me.
This, in some ways, is going to be deliberately ignorant as a question. Part of your coaching work, your people development work, has focused on developing groups of women or women individually. And I'm just curious if in your coaching work there are any particular challenges or development needs that you've encountered or that you pay attention to for men and or women discreetly.
I'll answer that two ways. I think that men and women are more alike than we give ourselves credit for sometimes. I think, especially when it comes to using our voice, using our influence, having courage to speak up when we know we need to speak up. And that's all learned. And we need mentors to help us with that. We need coaches to help us with that so we can grow and stretch and practice. I think we all need people to help us. Tim Burke, when he was at OPPD, he took 16 men offsite to the LEAD Conference Center, all white men, to learn about white male privilege. And one of my really good friends went through that program. He said, I had no idea what got just attributed to me for being a man, a white man. I had no idea that ads were created because of the way I think, that systems were structured because of the way I think. I've had so much power, and I'm a dad of girls. I don't want that to be the case anymore. He was crying and talking about what he learned. And I applaud Tim for doing what he did and having the desire to just open that up for discussion as a leader, because that is his privilege, is to think about what do people need inside this corporation that I can give them based on my values and my beliefs.
I want to turn that then to you. At a certain point, you embarked on this work as a consultant, an advisor, a coach. So what have you learned about business as a business person And especially important, what have you learned about yourself?
I can remember the day I decided, again, this is Meg Wheatley, to walk out to walk on. And I remember that I felt as though I had done as much as I could inside of corporations in the way that I wanted to do it. I really didn't want to get to the top seat in human resources, which would be where I would go, because I love developing people. That's what I love the most. I now know you can develop people at all levels inside of an organization, especially as a CEO. In fact, I would say that's your most important role, is developing people. And I had practiced that, studied that, gone to school for that, loved doing it, loved being one-on-one with people, helping them to think about what they most wanted to be, what they most were trying to become, and providing them tools and resources to do that, whether it's assessments, conversations, practice, joining groups, watching them and observing them in a room and giving them feedback to tell them how they did. As I stepped out on my own, I was scared to death, Stuart. I was absolutely scared to death because I never would hire the people that were out on their own doing this work in the community. I'd always look for a big shop that was recognized, name recognition, to bring in to the corporations that I was supporting. And I thought, oh my God, who's going to hire me? No one will hire me. And I was fortunate that Mary Prefontaine from ICANN was the person who said, do you want to facilitate defining leadership for women? And to do that, you'd want to go through the class. And going through that class and sitting and being a learner, which I really hadn't been in a long time, sitting and being a student of a course, I realized that there was so much to the group that developed me, so much to the people around me. The facilitators were great. They were phenomenal. But it was the class and where I saw myself in relationship to other people. So in starting my business, I felt like what was core to me was helping people discover themselves in relationship to others. And to do that in a group, to do that at one-on-one, to do that as a speaker, and to give people the opportunity to see themselves in who they were. Go back through your performance reviews and look at how you were described. There's some great books I use that help people outline who they are, you know, and grabbing the tools to help people define their values, their personal mission, their personal brand, who they are, what they want to do in life. And that helped me learn how to run my business. As I described, you know, the CEO as being the developer, as the CEO of the Learning Exchange, my work is, I am the brand of development. And I want to be really good at that. I want to be extraordinary at that, one-on-one and in groups. I think what I've learned by running a business is that I want to always be chasing my passion and doing work that I love. And fortunately, I got really clear about who I was at that 25-year point. And by the time I went out on my own, I was probably about the 28th year point, and knew that that would be my business. That was how I would define myself, as an exchange of learning back and forth, me learning from you, you learning from me, us taking that out into the world and making a difference.
So referencing these periods of time makes me want to jump back, as it were, to the source. And I want to ask you, what stands out to you from your childhood?
Well, I was a girl and the only girl, and in a family that was very 1950s. my dad and my mom. My dad worked, my mom didn't. I was raised to be polite and kind and filled with grace. And those are things I like about myself a lot. But I also had really tough brothers who had their own unique personalities, and they didn't let me be too much of a girly girl, you know, which I actually didn't love. I struggled with that because I didn't know what it meant for girls and boys. Like, how do you connect? So that was a lot of work for me throughout my life because there were these very defined things that I was supposed to do and they were supposed to do. And they couldn't get away with pummeling me, like playing typewriter on me. That wasn't okay, or lots of kinds of kid things that brothers do. My younger brother was super sweet and would really let me do anything I wanted to him, teach him, dress him. He was fun. He was a lot of fun. My older brother was a little bit more dynamic. So I think I learned in that family of five that there were role-appropriate things that I was supposed to do, but I was also being raised at a time of Gloria Steinem. So, you know, I really saw both worlds as very dynamic, and I graduated midterm from high school. I was 17 and a half and took a class from a lesbian feminist on women's history and learned things I'd never learned before and didn't even know what a lesbian feminist was, and became a card-carrying Now member and got my Ms. magazine. And so I had these like dualities in my life. And I really do think as I've grown my life, I've grown to be a strong voice for women, supporting women, helping women to step into their power, but also still learning the whole nature of men, but also a sister with brothers. And, you know, I understand the world of that dynamic in work. And I think we all have that to work through in our lives, don't you? I think that we kind of treat the people at work as though they're our families, and there could be work that we need to be doing on that family dynamic, me included.
You ended up in Omaha because of a man, specifically Rich. So he did die recently, and we'll come to that. But you came to Omaha because of him. So how did you meet?
I did come because of him. And I will tell you, 34 years later, I really get him. I really, really get him. So we met over dinner with friends, and we were not being set up. Rich was out skiing with his friend John, and I was going to spend the night with my friend Cindy. But I really, really liked him a lot. He was warm and friendly and not pretentious. And he was interested in me and talkative and asked a lot of questions. But he wouldn't have been my type as types go. He was blue collar, which my dad had been. My dad had worked in construction, and Rich was an electrician. Didn't go to college, pretty simple guy, oldest of six, Catholic. That wasn't how I was raised. So all those things that they tell you in marriage and family relations, we would not have been a match. But, oh, did I like him a lot. And so after he left, I said to Cindy, see, that's the kind of guy I should date, someone like that. And Rich and I had both been married before, short-term marriages that lasted about 13, 14 months. And, you know, they say second marriages may not last either, and especially our kind of marriage, because we met, we wrote, we called for 6 months. And in 6 months, from January to June, I was moving to Omaha, Nebraska, and living here for the rest of my life. And Rich, this is known now because we talked about it at his service, his celebration of life. Rich was a recovering alcoholic. He had a very intentional way of living his life. He was sober for 42 years. He exercised, rode his bike 4,000 miles in COVID, for example. He was healthy. He ate well. He didn't smoke. He didn't have high cholesterol, high blood pressure. And he was an incredible model for me because we were 9.5 years apart to look at and think, good grief, you know, I don't know how I'm going to keep up with him when I'm in my 70s and he's in his 80s. He's amazing. We had no children. We had a great life. We traveled a lot. We both had small businesses. He was a big catalyst for me starting mine. I could see him being successful. So we had this wonderful life, not without frustration. Marriages are frustrating, not without challenges. Long-term marriages especially can be challenging, but we loved each other at our core. And Rich was diagnosed November 16th with Lou Gehrig's disease, also known as ALS. And he had it, we think, for about a year by that point. And he lived 13 months after his diagnosis.
Could you just share a little bit then about what is Lou Gehrig's disease? It's ALS. What is that? And how did it start to show so that you and Rich started to suspect something wasn't right?
ALS is a motor neuron disease, and the disease tells your brain to shut down every part of your body. And there's only 5,000 people diagnosed a year with ALS, and it's been around since 1869. No cure, no treatment. Very difficult to diagnose. So it often starts in the limbs, and you might just notice that your ankle feels different, or your hand feels funny, or walking differently, or something's happening. And it takes a long time to get diagnosed for that reason. Rich started in the bulbar, where 25% of ALS patients start. And the bulbar is the part that controls breathing, swallowing, and speaking. And his began with speaking. We were in Hawaii. He just wasn't himself. He wasn't talking a lot. And I said, I think something's wrong. And he knew, he told me later, he knew that his speech was something was different about his speech. And that's the tongue not working properly. So we saw a neurologist in May who didn't see it, didn't identify it as anything. She just thought he was aging. And Rich was skipping out of that meeting with that neurologist. He was so excited that everything was fine. But I said, everything's not fine, Rich. You have something going on and we've got to get to the bottom of it. You know, you don't want that diagnosis. You want anything but. You want Parkinson's, that you can live longer with that. You don't want to watch someone lose their life to a disease that has no treatment, no cure, and it's going to shut down his entire body and he will still be clear and alert and know everything that's going on. It's devastating. And I have made friends with people who are caregivers of ALS patients and ALS patients through support groups that Rich had, that I still go to that support group to see those people. They're the most amazingly strong people. But with 5,000 people getting it only every year, there's no money for it. And so it's a long time. Isn't that 160 years almost we've been living with ALS? We need to figure this out.
You said something earlier in the context of realizing you wanted to be in business for yourself. And part of what you loved about your work was helping people discover themselves through the relationships with and the discovery of other people around them. And I'm wondering the extent to which that passion, that experience was useful to you and to Rich during this year or so together, and also perhaps just where it just fell short in the trauma of it all.
I will say that this is now my model of what it means to lead. And especially in those things we've talked about, that authentic, supportive, diverse. You know, when Rich was starting to lose his ability to speak, he was still trying so hard to talk to people. And even over the phone, trying to order food. And people would get frustrated with him and he'd hand the phone to me. And I realized that we don't understand when people have a disease like ALS or Parkinson's or MS or any neurological disorder, or even Alzheimer's, how to love and how to care and how to be compassionate and advocate and be there for them. And I know that my life's work prepared me to be there for Rich, to be there 100% as his advocate, as his support, as his coach. You know, we had conversations that were really hard to have, that I would patiently sit with him and we would talk about the really hard things that he wanted to talk about. He had his friend Dave come over and sit with him and interview him so that Dave could give his eulogy at Rich's celebration of life. And he did a beautiful job. But Rich knew that. Rich knew the moment he got the diagnosis that he was dying, even though he didn't want to live like he was dying. He woke up every day with purpose. He woke up every day to live. We had a friend that died from cancer just a few months before he was diagnosed. And she would say things like, "I get to," and "not now." These were her mantras. And so he adopted those as his. And I think that one of the things we did was Rich got to be Rich. You know, I wanted to travel. I wanted him to have some adventures. He didn't want to. He wanted to watch baseball and hockey and have friends over and eat as long as he could and enjoy good food. And when that ended, he would adapt to the feeding tube. And because it did, because you can't swallow. We made a loving partnership with that feeding tube. I would stand with Rich and hold it and stroke his hair and stroke his back and, you know, put my legs between his legs. And we would make that six times a day a loving, compassionate time. And when he was dying, Rich died like no one I've ever expected dies. I thought when you die, it's, you know, shallow breathing and 4 days and, you know, it's long. That didn't happen with him. On the 26th of December, the day before he died, he had visitors coming over to see him because we knew, you know, it was probably about a week or so. And he was thumbs up and smiling. And he went out and delivered cookies 4 days before he passed. And Rich was going to live till the end of his life. And that taught me that we go in the direction that people are ready and we help them develop whatever that development is. And the trauma, you asked about the trauma. I thought when Rich passed, I'd have to move out of that house because he died at home in hospice. And we never had to go anywhere else with him. We had nurses. We had long-term care insurance. Thank God that we could get private nursing support to help him for about 40 hours a week. They were amazing. They were loving and generous and kind. The trauma is of, you know, losing somebody that you love so desperately and now needing to move through life alone. And I've met with a couple of mediums that were gifts to me. And the gift they've given me is that when we leave, we're not gone. And we're always here for the people that we've left behind whenever they need us. And that's comforting to me. So ALS is a hard, hard, hard disease to watch. But I think if you can go through that or some hard thing in your life, it's transformative. And that transformation becomes wisdom. And for me, that's important for the work that I do.
We're having this conversation and grief is something that is familiar in many ways to everybody and yet also unique to our own individual experience of it. What has this experience, acknowledging the rawness of it all, now prepared you for as you look to the future, the third act, the next phase for you?
Yeah. I think one of the things that we did, not just I did, Rich still attended his meetings 3 times a week over Zoom. We went to a caregiver group meeting, a patient group meeting that was out of Chicago, given to us by some friends whose daughter has a form of ALS. And so we started going to that. I called a group of women friends together once a month called Our People to support me as I was grieving. And a lot of times I would just cry and they would literally hold me on that Zoom. When we planned Rich's service, he planned 3/4 of it and really thought about what he wanted, who would speak, what the music would be, who the performers would be. He really thought that through, and we honored him with that, including some really unique things, I think, that we had a Buddhist and a Christian and a Jewish couple talk about where we go when we die, because Rich didn't know, and he was okay with that. But he loved the idea of people being educated during that service, and he thought that would be really fun. So I say that because I know that going forward, community and relationships have always been important to me, and that will be what takes me forward. So we're taking Rich out to Scatter him May 5th and going to the places that he and I loved. So we'll go to San Francisco, Sausalito, Mendocino, down the coast to Aptos, where a friend lives, and then over to Yosemite to Scatter him. There'll be about 12 of us there to Scatter him. And I had hearts made of Rich, and in those hearts is just a tiny bit, I'll show you one after, just a tiny bit of his ashes. And I'll take those to places that we've gone, and I'll take him with me everywhere I travel in the future. And I know that I had probably the best partner, the best love I could have ever asked for in my life. I don't think I was always as grateful for it as I should have been and will be for the rest of my life. And I have no idea what's coming ahead of me. I've been a planner, a goal setter. Maybe I'll get back to that. But right now I'm just saying yes to whatever opportunities are coming and trying to live in the way I've lived with Rich. Because it was so good and so me. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful for that in a couple I found myself in partnership with another. So I don't know. There's something in the grief, though, too, Stuart, that I know I want to incorporate into corporations, because we don't let ourselves grieve endings at work. We won't talk about where that person went, especially if it was a termination. I get that. I've talked with a lot of my HR friends about this idea of, can we do grief differently? What would it look like if we really could bring people together to talk about what it feels like not to have Bob here anymore? And what are we going to miss? And that it would be okay to call Bob and to let Bob know that you're thinking of him instead of, We're just done, because that's not normal. I don't believe that's not healing. That's not helping. That's not grieving. And we have to process grief.
My guest today has been Laura Rocafort, an organizational development consultant, leadership coach. Laura, I can't thank you enough for being so generous in sharing your experience in the world, but also your personal experiences. So thank you.
Thank you, Stuart.
Lives is brought to you on KIOS Omaha Public Radio and is produced by Courtney Bierman. The music you hear playing in and playing out is performed by Andrew Bailey. Podcasts of today's show and others can be found at livesradioshow.com or where you get your podcasts. Subscribe today and please leave a review. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden. Join me next week as we delve further into the practical and profound possibilities of living well. Thanks for listening.